April, first Sunday roundtable debate, as we like to do this. This is our political debate. We do it once a month, and this morning we have some new faces, and we're going to ask the panelists to introduce themselves, because I'd rather for them to get into this than for me to get into the thick of it all. And Dean, I'll start with you. Dean Meyerson, Green Party, why don't you introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Dean Meyerson, political coordinator with the Green Party, working out of our office in downtown Washington, D.C.
All right.
Yes, and I'm Paul Carlson. I'm a state delegate in the Maryland legislature, and I represent District 39, which is in the northern part of Montgomery County.
I'm Jim Parmley. I'm a political consultant, and I run a political action committee called NorthernVirginiaGOP.com.
I'm Nick Sarwark. I'm the chair of the Libertarian Party of Maryland.
So we have Green Party, Libertarian, Democrat, Republican, right here together. And this first Sunday roundtable, let's get things started because there is a lot to talk about on our agenda. To start with, the Bush administration and the Mideast. Colin Powell sent to the Mideast this week. What can he do? There's an awful lot of talk, the fact that Colin Powell may can go over to he's talked to the Palestinians. He's to talk with pretty much carry the Bush message, and that message is, let's calm down. Do you think it'll work?
Well, let me first of all say I'm glad to see that the Bush administration is finally, and I think it's been long overdue, putting a little more clout and a little more energy into the Middle East, because that the situation has been deteriorating. And I think those efforts will yield some benefit, but it's going to take the full effort, the weight of the White House to really get involved in this effort and to force both sides to come to the table to get to the peace process. So I'm very hopeful, but I guess I'm just glad that the White House is finally starting to focus and put some energy behind this effort.
Dean?
Well, I think the big word for the Bush administration policy in the Mideast is disarray. I mean, he changes constantly. It doesn't seem that there's any sense of what planning ahead or figuring out what the impacts are. Pressure comes. He changes right in the middle of everything. I can't be optimistic that his particular policy is going to have a long-term improvement in the situation.
Jim, I'm going to save you the last so you can bring up the end there. I'll go to my buddy Nicholas, Libertarian.
I think we're in a hard position in trying to bring some peace to the Middle East, as we subsidize one of the countries involved in the conflict and we don't subsidize the other one. And it's really seen as a hindrance in our policy negotiations. And I think that until we get a little more even-handed policy towards the countries in the Middle East, it's very hard for us to be that honest broker. But I wish Colin Powell luck.
Okay.
I think sending Secretary Powell is the right thing to do. But let me start off by saying, we had 8 years of Bill Clinton, and he seemed to want to just take action to take action. And 8 years of churning did not bring peace to the Middle East. And President Bush is someone who's supremely confident in his own skin, and he knows that you don't just jump into something just to jump in. And I don't think any of us in this room, and probably no one out there listening, none of us know how to bring peace to the Middle East. We can't do it. The United States can't do it. It has to be the people on the ground in the Middle East realizing that killing each other, that they've just had enough of it. And I think Secretary Powell going over there to talk to them is going to be a good thing. But this is not something that we can impose on them. These folks have to realize that they have to sit down and negotiate themselves.
You can't have it both ways. Under the Clinton administration, it certainly was better in terms of a violence perspective than it is now. And whether they had the right approach or the wrong approach, at least they were active in their approach, and therefore the violence was less than it is now. And it's only now that it reached such a critical and dangerous level, quite frankly, for the whole world community, that now, reluctantly, the Bush administration is getting involved. So call the Clinton policies what you will, at least the violence was less, and they got closer to peace than certainly they are now.
Well, this is a war that's been going on for some time, but the whole point here is all over the world, even within the United States, there are those pointing their fingers to the White House saying, when are you going to do something? Was Colin Powell sent over there as a time buyer, as a Band-Aid to put on this big wound that we have in the Middle East, just to buy time until somebody makes a decision as to how much they're going to get involved?
I think, he has a lot of credibility around the world, and a lot of people respect him, and I think both sides over there respect him. And so if you're going to send someone over there to sit him down and try to talk, he's a good person to send. But he's not a miracle worker, and we shouldn't expect that. I'm not sure. I mean, if President Bush had decided, you know what, we're simply not going to be involved, I would have been okay with that, too. I don't think an American president can impose peace upon two warring peoples who just keep fighting. And I think that, you know, we're talking about we're subsidizing one side and not the other. The United States subsidizes everybody in this world. I mean, we send more foreign aid around the world.
We got 300 troops going into the Philippines this morning.
We sell one group guns and we give another group food. And that's a big difference in subsidies.
There is no one in the Middle East that's having a hard time getting guns.
Telephone number 301-230-0980, #980, the Verizon Wireless System. Absolutely free call, like for you to get into the action here with our first Sunday roundtable. As we speak about the various issues that we've been talking about all week or in the news, right now we're focusing on the Mideast and the war in the Mideast, Colin Powell going to the Mideast, and the question about the American media. The Israelis sent a lot of people out of one of the townships last week. NBC, CNN, everybody was on the run because Israeli soldiers said, look, just get out of here. We don't want you here. But the question is, has the American media been too one-sided? You would think that Palestinians, all Palestinians in the world, are idiots and all of them are violent. All Palestinians are violent. That's an observation that one critic had of the American media in reporting on this war. What about that, Dean?
Well, I think that the media sometimes does report the problems and the violence that the Palestinians are subject to, but the underlying problems and processes they haven't reported on. I've talked to people who've been there who've described extensive nonviolent protests by Palestinians that nobody ever hears about, that nobody in this country knows have ever existed. Now, I'm certainly opposed to all the violence that's going on there, but if you don't know the background and what people have tried to do ahead of time, it's a big problem in figuring out what will work now. And so the media is just jumping in there all of a sudden, trying to go there, trying to go through the Israeli barricades, and it just doesn't give people the background they need.
Paul, do you think it's been too one-sided for the media?
I think certainly the media needs to do a better job at showing both sides of the conflict. And I think doing a better job at giving some more context to the conflict. I think a lot of people turn on the tube and they see the conflict and the violence, and they don't necessarily understand the background or the context in which that's occurring, which I think lends itself to us as a people understanding that world and that community and trying to have us do a better job at brokering some sort of a peace agreement, if that's even possible.
As far as background, I've noticed that foreign coverage has actually gotten better since after September 11th, but the real problem is if Sharon's pursuing a policy of isolation, he's isolating not only Arafat in a compound, but he's also essentially isolating the entire West Bank from reporters. Reporters have been expelled, and the only reporters that are in there are like war reporters in countries they're not really welcome in. So it's difficult to have a non-one-sided coverage if you're able to get access to one side and you're not able to get access to the other. And I think that that's going to eventually cause a real credibility problem for the Israeli position if you can't get any news out of Ramallah.
So you're saying that Sharon is controlling the media?
I'm saying that Ramallah has been turned into a military occupation zone, and thus media aren't allowed in. It's not really controlling, though, so much as, you know, if they can't get to the story, then they can't report on it.
Okay. We're talking with Dean Myerson of the Green Party, Paul Carlson, a Democrat, along with James Parmalee, a Republican, and Nicholas Sowak, who is Libertarian. This is our first Sunday roundtable, 301-230-0980, #980, in the Verizon wireless system. We'll take a few more calls, or I'd say we'll deal with this whole war thing just a few moments. We have so much on the agenda. Let's go to Jerry in Virginia. Good morning, Jerry.
Yeah, good morning. You know, I really think that the media has been one-sided, and it's really kind of late. You know, the horse is already out the barn trying to cover the other side. My position is that, you know, there are things that I don't agree with that Israel has done, but at this stage, I have really felt that they have really been restrained, you know, with the suicide murderers and it's been escalating, and I can't disagree with the fact that they're going in to try to eradicate these folks, because the basic premise of those guys over there is not really to negotiate. They want to eradicate Israel. So I mean, it's difficult to negotiate with people who have that premise. also I'm looking at the fact that Bush is playing, I feel that he's playing both sides of the middle, because, you know, a lot of people forget the fact that in the 1967 war, you know, Egypt, you know, Syria, and all that whole region was against Israel. And I think they're using the Palestinians as a way to get back at the Israel without actually going and do it themselves.
Okay.
Because nobody has really offered any land. Any of these other people that offered any land for the Palestinians to have a homeland of their own.
Jerry, thank you very much for your call. Appreciate your call. What about that, gents?
You know, I think a key thing is that the issue is not negotiating with suicide bombers. The goal of the suicide bombers is to make sure that there's no moderate on either side to be involved in this issue. So the issue is that, and the Israelis are essentially satisfying them by their policy of invading the West Bank. We don't now know, have a position where the radicals on both sides are essentially setting policies, and those in the middle are being drawn to the radical, and there's nobody advocating nonviolence.
Sometimes, I'll tell you though, sometimes it's the hardliners. It is the hardliners who really can negotiate. It was Nixon who negotiated with China. These are the, you know, maybe this is a situation where it has gotten so bad. It has gotten so bad that perhaps we can actually get some negotiations going.
Bush is in really a tough position because he's trying to serve two masters. I mean, traditionally Israel's been an ally, but at the same time, Bush is pretty dead set on attacking Iraq until he gets some support from the Arab world. He can't attack Iraq, so you have to support the Palestinian side, but at the same time, you have to support the Israeli side. So it's going to be very difficult. It's just a hard job. I'm not envious.
Okay. We can continue to talk about the war, but there's some other things that we have to deal with. For instance, right back home here in the state of Maryland, Republicans and Libertarians have announced their candidates for the gubernatorial race in Maryland. Will they cut into the Townsend camp is the question. So far, Mrs. Townsend, Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, has the name Kennedy, and they say she has lots of dough and that she will most likely be the next governor of Maryland. Paul, would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. And she came through Montgomery County a week or so ago, and a number of us endorsed her candidacy at that time. Look forward to her serving as the governor. But I just want to say it's not just that she has the Kennedy name and that she has a lot of resources behind her, but it's what is indicative of those resources. She's been lieutenant governor for the past 8 years. We've had an incredible 8 years in Maryland doing lots of great things for the people of Maryland. Just passed a landmark education funding bill in the legislature just yesterday. And those, among many other environmental initiatives, healthcare initiatives, et cetera, we've gone a long way to doing right by the people of Maryland. And I think she's going to continue that work.
But I didn't know Kathleen Kennedy Townsend had a candidacy. Has she announced while I wasn't listening?
Well, she hasn't officially announced, but
do you know why that is?
I think she's waiting, quite frankly, for the legislative session to end, which will be on Monday.
Okay.
And might it be she's waiting to figure out what her positions are on major issues?
I don't think so. She just came out.
Well, there's one issue, guys. There's one issue that is really tickling a lot of people, and Doug Duncan has been saying, the county exec of Montgomery County, he's been 100% behind it. Kathleen Townsend came down and met with Doug Duncan. They talked about it. Glenn Denning has been a dark horse in this whole thing. He says he wants to have nothing to do with it. And I'm talking about the ICC, the inter-county connection. Now, what about this? Certainly, Robert Eric, who is now the candidate for the Republican Party in Maryland, says he's all for it, plus gambling.
Well, now they're both for the ICC, and Glenn Denning wasn't, but interestingly enough, during the campaign last time, he said he was for it, and then he decided he was against it. And he went back and forth and back and forth, it seems to me it's a road that needs to be built. I'm a Virginian, so I'm not an expert on the road structures of Maryland, but it does seem if you have both party candidates now agreeing to do it, it sounds like the right thing to do.
I just want to, you know, bring the discussion back to candidates that are actually declared, like Spear Lancaster, who's running to, you know, restore power to the citizens of Maryland, better their lives and their communities, and giving voters more choice than they've had in the last 36 years. It's been 36 years since there's been an option for Maryland voters that's outside of the two-party system.
And that's what Robert Earl has been saying. He says that, yes, Maryland is very much a Democratic state, But he plans, his challenge is to change this. Marylanders won't necessarily vote Democrat.
Ehrlich is not going to change the political landscape of Maryland. Speer Lancaster is going to change the political landscape of Maryland.
How so?
Community solutions for community problems.
I know that sounds nice.
Doesn't it, though?
Nick,
I like it, too.
I mean, come on, I need something more. That's like Kathleen Townsend says, yeah, I'm for the ICC today, but tomorrow I'm not.
They'll give anyone a line on the ballot these days, won't they?
Can't we find politicians who have some type of either consistency,
Spirit,
or they have at least some type of concrete
Spear's major
plan?
Issues are education. He wants to increase the delivery alternatives and push the control down to the local level. And look at some more options beyond. Let's put more money into it until it gets better. And
what does that mean? Delivery options?
Delivery options for education. It means better public schools that are run by local boards and not by Annapolis, as maybe PG County, I think. It means charter schools. It means looking at vouchers.
PG County, you're referring to the General Assembly.
Taking over the PG County School Board, kicking them out for 5 years? Yeah.
Not the General Assembly, but the educational system in Maryland.
Yeah.
Right, okay. We're talking about Maryland right now, the state of Maryland, and the gubernatorial race, which is going to have lots of fire. And our guests here, Nicholas Sawalk, along with James Palmerly, and, of course, Paul Carlson and Dean Meyerson. On the line, Stacy. Good morning, Stacy.
Good morning. I'd like to talk something about what you were talking about before, the financial aid that we're giving to other countries. It's not that I don't think we shouldn't give any, but the problem that I have with it is that there are a lot of people in this country that are hardworking people that need things like daycare, you know, need solutions like that, and yet we're giving money to all these other countries and not taking care of what's going on in our own backyard, and I find that very offensive.
Okay.
Well, I'm with you on that. I think that we probably spend too much in foreign aid. I mean, there are some good programs that we do and that should be helped. But a lot of times, I mean, it's one of those things where if you have problems at home, the money should stay at home.
Are we giving a lot of money to not only Israel, but to the Palestinians as well as Jordan and other countries in the Mideast?
Well, I mean, the money that's being given abroad by the United States is tiny compared to the kinds of subsidies the corporations and other types of entities that doesn't serve the interests of the people. If we want to find the money for the types of things the caller mentioned, and I absolutely think we should, there are better places to find it than our tiny foreign aid budget.
Okay.
Well, I'm against corporate welfare, too. I'm a small government, you know, I'm a small government type of Republican. And so a lot of these, there are a lot of programs out
most
there that I think...
Most Republicans are.
You know, sometimes...
Except the Ronald Reagan building.
Oh, no. Ronald Reagan was
Ronald
Reagan building.
Yeah.
But well, you know, if you're going to build a wasteful government building anyway, you might as well name it after a great American.
Funny that because foreign aid is at the root of it, corporate welfare. Foreign aid is the other hand. It's the other side of gunboat diplomacy. It's the carrot. The Marines are the stick. I'm surprised. I mean, of course, you're not really big in foreign aid either, are you?
I'm a conservative Republican, and President Bush is a conservative Republican, and he's looking at smaller government. He's from Texas. A state that appreciates small government, and I think he's doing the right thing, and the president is looking to streamline government, and I think he's headed that direction.
But I want to clarify.
But he is spending money on foreign aid. I know that's where.
I think there's a big misperception out in the community about how much foreign aid we actually spend. I mean, less than, I believe these figures are correct, but less than 1%. I think it's around even 0.5%. Of our federal expenditures are on any kind of foreign aid. It's a very small percent of any of the money that we have out there going to do important programs. But Republicans often talk about having a smaller government. But at the end of the day, if you look at the size of government, the expenditures that we spent, the money that we didn't have, giving tax cuts away but asking government to spend more, it seems to be a trend over the past 20 years. When Republicans get into office, we have our federal deficit exploding, and then Democrats have to come in and do the hard work of filling the gap.
Is that true, Green Party, Dean?
We think that the aid budget is also very small, and it really, when people focus on the aid budget, it's really not looking where they need to look from the issues of funding.
Okay. May I say, gentlemen, that we are talking about various issues, and if you'd like to call and voice your opinion or your comment, certainly do so. Our lines are open at 301-230-0980, pound 980 on the Verizon Wireless System. I have lines open right now, 301-230-0980, pound 980 on the Verizon Wireless System. Talking about spending money, the White House says that as far as welfare, back to work welfare and welfare reform, much of this is going to be turned over to the states, but there are some stipulations in turning it over to the states. One, they would like to encourage people on welfare to get married. And to encourage this, the Bush administration is proposing that they spend $350 million to campaign for welfare marriages. Not to help welfare marriages, but to campaign. That is to get the word out. If you're going on welfare or if you're on welfare, you should get married.
Amen.
Gentlemen, please.
Well, I don't think people need to be convinced to get married when they want to, and I don't think that the government is going to result in better quality marriages. High quality marriages clearly help children, but marriages that occur because it might help them get welfare or something like that isn't going to help children at all.
Well, look, this is an instance where the government has been for decades subsidizing people not being married. It has encouraged people not to be married on welfare. It makes it easier, and you get more money if you're not married on welfare. So what President Bush is really doing is saying no to the failed welfare policies of the past.
But isn't this, gentlemen, a little bit of a touch from the quote-unquote Bible Belt politics, the fact that marriage is such a moral thing? What do you do
Amen.
About...
Yeah, but that's a good thing.
Well, not necessarily. A lot of immoral marriages right now, we find the divorce rate going up. But let me ask you this, gentlemen. If you do push a program like this, marriages and welfare, what about the teenage pregnancies we have in this country? There are many teenagers who are not at the age of getting married and are on welfare as mothers.
But that's a big question, too. Or is he going to be advocating for 16-year-olds to get married just because they had a children so young?
The interesting thing about government money is that it passes through the filter of government, and it comes back with these strings on it that I swear weren't there when I sent in my check on April 15th. There were no strings attached to it. And look, there's strings all over it. Strings that say you need to be married, strings that say, basically, it would say the government thinks that the best way to run your life is like this. And if you want any of our money, which used to be your money until you gave it to us, you have to live your life like this. Otherwise, we get to keep it. And there's something wrong with that.
I'm going to talk to Michael Steele. Michael Steele, is this Michael Steele of the Maryland GOP?
Absolutely.
We have a lot to say about Michael Steele, don't we? Hello, Mike. How you doing?
Well, Jay, I apologize for missing last month, buddy. We had some scheduling conflicts and it all got messed up.
Well, it's typical of Republicans. They always show up in the back room.
I really wanted to applaud Nick on the most prescient comment of the morning, or question rather, that was to our esteemed delegate, how do you endorse a non-candidate?
Very carefully.
I mean, what happens, delegate, when Martin O'Malley, Mayor O'Malley of Baltimore, gets in the race and this thing heaps up all those eggs on that basket and he knocks Kathleen off in the primary? Don't you guys look a little bit foolish?
Paul?
Look, I think Kathleen is going to be a great governor. I think she would be the next governor of Maryland. I look forward to supporting her doing that. I think you'd have to be foolish, that's the right word, to assume that she's not running for governor. And I think she's quite frankly wise to hold off until the session's over. And
Why? Because they don't have to answer any questions from the reporters during the session on the very important bills. Like, where is Kathleen on this idea of taking control of the Prince George's County school system? I mean, here we have white Democrats in Annapolis, led by some very foolish black Democrats, I might add, who said to the people of Prince George's County, look, you folks just don't know what you're doing, so we're going to come in our all-knowing, all-powerful way and take control of your school system. Now, we've done it in the only two major black jurisdictions in this state. How come we aren't looking at other school systems in the state and doing the same thing?
Wait,
where's Kathleen on that?
Hang on. First of all, I want to take issue with the race element of that equation there. The Maryland legislature, the county government, the Board of Education are all creatures of the state. And they're elected officials in Montgomery County. The Montgomery County delegation, led by an African-American, by the way, has voted to take some intervention measures, which, given the state of the Prince George's County School Board and the superintendent, they believe is the right thing to do. And as colleagues of theirs and looking in the best interest of the state.
Well, have they talked to the people who live in the county and who elected those school board members?
Well, they are elected. They are elected by those same people.
Just to jump in, Speer Lancaster, www.speer2002.com supports
is
local control of schools.
Do you have to pay airtime for that?
I don't know. Do I?
I got a call from the sales department. Up here, advertising. No, go right ahead. It's political talk, I would take it.
Political speech.
Right. Michael, hold on the line. Can you hold on, Michael? We got John in Fairfax. John, please come in and help us out.
Yes, good morning. I heard some discussion about our aid program. And, yes, our aid program is less than 1% of the federal budget. But on the other hand, our aid program has a history of mismanagement and corruption that goes back for years and years under the Clinton administration. It really started to go bad. As an example, I point out the South African program, which was based purely on race, that our aid money was only going to organizations based on race. And then
What do you mean based on race?
Well, the main criteria for receiving contracts and grants in South Africa was that the organization, both South African and the United States, had to have a board of directors or an owner or a president that was black. That's been documented, and that's, I thought our Constitution said we don't do things based on race, creed, or color. And then you take other aid missions, like in Russia, where we gave the money to Clinton's friends over at Harvard, and they had inside trading and whatnot. And finally, the HIID, Harvard Institute of International Development.
Okay, let me just tell you, I think over the last 8 years with Bill Clinton, we spent a lot of money on foreign aid, and we didn't get anything for it. And I don't mean to just single out foreign aid, although I will say it is something that really activates the Republican base. People are upset about it, and Democrats, and a lot of folks are upset about it, because they see it as money going away from our homes. We have enough problems in the United States that we need to take care of the home front first, but we also need to be engaged in the world. But I'm for limited government. I think we need to roll back a lot of these programs, not just pick on foreign aid, but a lot of them, and get back to the limited government.
Government foreign aid is a political tool. It's the carrot, the military is the stick, and if you don't like the way it's being spent, the aid needs to come from people who can agree on what they want to give it to and who they want to give it to and what they want to give it for.
Yeah, a key thing with aid is that it usually is not designed to help the people who are receiving it, but to serve, whether it's foreign policy goals or to increase sales of U.S. companies abroad. Very little of it is actually designed to help the people who receive it.
This is Metro Talk from Oldies 100, Sport Talk 980. I'm Jerry Phillips with my panelists this morning on our first Sunday roundtable. Dean Meyerson is with the Green Party. Paul Carlson, who is Democrat, Maryland House of Representatives, filling in for our own Dana Jones. I have to put her name in, otherwise she will be back here soon. James Pomeroy, who is Republican, Northern Virginia, GOP.com. And Nicholas Sowak, who is Libertarian, Maryland. He's the chair of the Maryland Libertarian Party. Our telephone number, 301-230-0980, #980, on the wireless system of Verizon Wireless System. Let's go to Pat in Alexandria. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning, my darling. Great show as usual.
Thank you.
And I hate to say this, Nicholas, but I agree with you again.
Oh, two times in a row. Oh, my
yeah,
gosh.
This is really scary.
Well, he's practically a Republican, so come on over.
No, actually, I
resent that remark.
I was one of the original teenage Republicans in New York State, and the Republican Party I grew up in is not the Republican Party that exists now. Thank you. What can I say?
It's a Libertarian Party.
We're working on it very quickly.
I think there's two points that have to come up on this. Going back to the discussion of the Middle East, I think that what we're dealing with now, and I realize that a lot of our foreign aid goes because, frankly, Israel is the only democracy sitting in the Middle East right now. But I am concerned when we talk about this, and as Nicholas knows, I'm the mother of one of the sticks that we send in after the carrot. My concern on this right now is that we're dealing with over 50 years of hatred. We're dealing with over 50 years of problems. And I'm concerned whether or not our Middle East policy has not been affected by what happened on September 11th. I'd like to hear what the gentlemen have to say about it.
Thank you very much, Pat. Well,
it's,
they all sound.
It's as fun a place to go as the Balkans, and it wasn't really a good idea to go there. Getting involved in racial animosities that have been going on for a long, long time is generally a sticky situation to get into. It's a tar baby.
Well, the effect of the September 11th is that the Bush administration needs the support of the Arab countries for some of its policies more than ever before. Maybe not more than before, but they've realized they need it more than before, so that is probably why they're actually going in there.
Okay.
I think President Bush looks at this as the United States leads, and people can either follow or not. And people are saying, giving him a hard time for being, you know, some sort of isolationist, which he never was. But, you know, President Bush, I think, you know, a lot of it comes from being from Texas. Texans go their own way. They do what they believe is right, and they stick to it. And I think the rest of America likes that. I like that. And, President Bush is not worried. He wants a coalition, but he doesn't have to have a coalition.
There's another I word people use a little more often. It doesn't. Imperialist, I think, is the one that gets bandied about a little more with our foreign policy as it stands now.
Going back to the caller's comment about the effect of September 11th, it is no question that there's a big wake-up call for this country and that we are not an island unto ourselves. It's a dangerous world out there. Whether we like it or not, we are a world power, and we have to play that role, and we can't be an isolationist country. And I think President Bush has realized, and I do think when he came into office, that was his policy stance, and I think that's taken a 180-degree turn for the better, quite frankly.
Michael, are you still on the line? Is Michael still on the line?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, Michael, I have one question before we let you go to put more fire fuel on the fire. Mm-hmm. Oprah Winfrey says no to Mr. Bush. Winfrey says that she doesn't want to be used by the White House. This is in reference to the White House project of going to Afghanistan, celebrities helping the school project. And Oprah Winfrey was like the key person. And since then, the White House has canceled the whole thing, or at least they postponed it. But
right.
Oprah says, no, I'm not going. I don't want to be used by Bush. How do you feel about that?
Well, Oprah's Oprah. God bless Oprah. The bottom line
is... Yeah, but she sells books, you know?
if Bush were Clinton, she'd be falling all over herself. She would have been in Afghanistan before I asked her. I mean, that's the reality of it. And you know, that's fine. You know, celebrities in Hollywood, you know, they have their uses. And, you know, if you want to promote an effort or support the president, great. If you don't, fine.
Okay,
Americans that can be asked to do it.
It's a free country,
Michael.
Thank God. And the government doesn't get to tell you you have to go. You get to ask. And if you say no, you say no. And that's why I like America.
Okay,
we got
about 5 more minutes of program. We've got 3 callers on the line. Let's go to them very quickly. Maurice in Silver Spring, good morning.
Hi, Jerry and panel. I find that even listening to Michael just now, Jerry, I find something very interesting. Probably in 2073, someone will still be bashing Bill Clinton instead of dealing with what's going on right now. If Bill Clinton or Tom Daschle or someone had proposed $350 million to encourage, allegedly, people to get married, it would be another one of those democratic, socialistic, engineering, fixing type things. And this is just a stupid idea to create a lot of bad marriages by saying, we'll give you money.
No. I'm going to have to jump in here. Look, this is not $350 million to force people into marriage. This is slowly starting to turn around the Titanic of the welfare system that has been splitting up families and keeping people from being married for years. It has been encouraging people not to get married, and this is a drop of federal money in the huge bucket saying, look, we're going to start to turn this ship around and say, you know what, it's okay, you can be married. It's good. Marriage is a good thing to do.
Okay.
I got to agree with you, though, Maurice. Clinton seems to come up a lot for a guy who's not in office anymore.
Okay, let's talk to Joel in Adelphi. Good morning, Joel.
Good morning, Jerry.
Good morning. Go right ahead, Joel.
I got a question on the ICC.
Yeah.
I hope they don't. Are they going to go with it, or are they going to use transit for the buses?
Okay.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. Thanks, Joel.
The Libertarian candidate, Spear Lancaster, supports the ICC. He supports doing it with as little environmental impact as possible, but the truth is we need the roads badly.
It's not an either-or situation. Quite frankly, the Washington metropolitan area, we need a a package of proposals. We need metro, we need more buses, and right. we need the ICC.
Transportation is a hot political story, and we always talk very quickly.
Well, it seems the Republicans support it, the Libertarians support it, the Democrats keep going back and forth, but sometimes they support it, so I guess it's going to be up to our Green Party representative to oppose
to pull it off.
Well, as a resident of the district, I don't know a lot of details about it.
But, the ICC.
But yeah, you know you don't like roads.
Usually we don't like roads.
Let's talk to Robin in Sterling. Good morning, Robin.
Yeah, hi, Jerry. Thanks for taking my call this morning.
No problem.
I'd like to move on to a different tack and get each representative's stand on the reparations for slavery, yes or no.
Okay. Thank you very much, Robin. Got to go. The whole thing about reparations for slavery, yes or no.
I think it's going to be it would be horrible to have African nations pay reparations to middle class Black Americans because all races were involved in slavery.
Green Party
says yes.
Okay, Democrats.
Don't know. I don't want to speak for all Democrats, but right. I'm not sure. I'm not even sure how we'd admit.
Libertarians.
If we can find the people who were exploited, and we can find the people who exploited them, then those people should make reparations.
Very quick statement, guys. We got about 20 seconds. One, the Postal Service has a new stamp campaign out, and guess what? They left out the District of Columbia. And this has to be a contest that the Postal Service has on best places in America to vacate to.
Well, as a member of the D.C. Statehood Green Party, this is just another example. I mean, D.C. took a major hit after September 11th in their tourism, and now because of the biased state, it just happens again and again.
Okay. Thank you very much. Gentlemen, nice talking with you. Sorry we couldn't get all more in, but certainly the next roundtable, I'm sure, will be feisty. Right. I want to thank our newcomers, Dean Meyerson, Green Party. Paul, thank you very much for sitting in for Dana. Paul Carlson, Democrat. James Pummerly, welcome to our roundtable, Republican, Northern Virginia, GOP.com. And also Nicholas Sawalk, as usual, chair of the Libertarian, Maryland Libertarian Party. Thank you very
Thanks
much.
Thanks a lot, Jerry.
Got to get out of here and thank those who helped to put it together, certainly this morning. Jonathan Lieb is our technical producer. Laurie Klein is our administrator. Jason Feller, public affairs assistant. Our simulcast operator is Brendan. And Metro Talk is written and produced by yours truly, Jerry Phillips. Metro Talk is an Oldies 100 Sports Talk 980 public affairs presentation from Clear Channel Radio in Washington, D.C. Till next time, my friend, much peace, much love. Take care of yourself.